from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with artist Mark Pack about his sculptures made of paint.
I'll find out about the Beckett Project at Butler University.
And then I get to preview the season finale for Ensemble Music, the Guarneri String Quartet. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call...
What'll we do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Artist Mark Pack makes sculptures out of paint. Or is it paintings out of sculpture? Maybe a better way to describe them is, imagine if an abstract expressionist painter was commissioned to create an exhibit for a natural history museum. However you describe them, you can see them in June at the Art Box Gallery. Travis DiNicola spoke with Pack about his work.
You know, I first saw your work, I think it was maybe about 6 months ago or so, maybe a little bit longer, at the Harrison Center. And I remember walking into the gallery space where your work was on display and thinking, I've never seen anything like this before. And I've certainly seen a lot of different types of artwork, but and I'm looking forward to you describing how you create your work. But I think the best way that I can describe it is that it's like taking a core sample of a whole bunch of paintings that have been stacked on top of each other, and you end up with this almost like a fossil sample. Is that that ends up being a sculpture or a painting or what have you? But I know there's a lot more to it than that. Tell me about your work.
That's exactly the way I think about them. Really, I think about them as sort of like rocks or fossils, and I'm building these paintings in a sort of fashion of many layers of acrylic paint at a time, and then there's sort of this working of erosion where I'll sand them after layers, and I'll cut into them with an X-Acto blade. Recently, I've started using like a wood planer to sort of shred the paintings apart, and then I'll reconstitute those shreddings back into the painting, and I'll make more layers on top of them. So I'm always constantly trying to think of a way of roading them and digging into them, and then I'll cover them back over again, and then I'll sand them more. And so there's this working back and forth of a process of trying to recreate what I see in nature.
You know, it's what's amazing to me. It's historically it's like almost bringing together, you know, ideas of really just, you know, the most abstract work where, you know, whether it's color field or it's just, you know, the paint on the canvas is the work itself. And then at the same time, you're linking to almost this like sort of natural history museum idea of like samples of somewhere in history. I mean, whether it's, you know, like a core sample or a fossil or what have you, because you actually like sort of take these physical layers of the acrylic paints that are then, you know, sort of cut and you see the layering in the insides, and then you mount them either on the wall or on pedestals, you know, so that it almost, you know, at one point looks as if it could be from a natural history museum.
Right. And I sort of got that idea from when I was at RISD for my MFA program. I worked at a place called the Nature Lab. And we had fossils and rocks, you know, for artists to draw from. So I think when I started to think about my own work and what I wanted to create, I wanted to sort of figure out how you could make like a butterfly wing instead of painting it, how you can make a butterfly wing. And to me, there's a difference.
Yeah.
Because it kind of evolves and it kind of grows a life on its own instead of me controlling it. And you're right. I'll take those and I'll frame them in such a way that they look like they would be in a natural history museum, or even display them in that sense, so that people can sort of reference that right away, and often people usually do.
But at the same time, you're still, you know, echoing this great history of abstract art. Of,
yeah.
You know, the you know, going beyond the image, that the paint itself is, you know, what is making the art on the canvas.
Right, right. Well, I want them to act both as paint and as something else.
Yeah.
So I want them to act in both worlds, and I feel like I'm fusing the world of abstract art, abstract expressionism, with a kind of realism. And what I mean by that is I mean by that the world is made of many abstract elements that sort of fuse together to make a tree, to make a rock, to make a house.
Mm-hmm.
If you take little miniature pictures of those, you'd never really be able to tell what what a microscope takes. You wouldn't be able to tell exactly what that image is. You'd have to blow it up to see a tree.
Sure.
At first, you'd only see, like, cells and stuff like that.
Okay.
So that's sort of what I'm thinking about.
Interesting. And then, and you also don't get that sense when it's represented some other way of what the object's actually made of, where with yours, it's like, yeah, you're using the paint to make it.
Right.
Again, not just represent it, but actually create it. Which leaves me wondering, when you were a kid, did you like art museums or natural history museums better, or do you remember?
When I was a kid is just collecting rocks and collecting natural objects.
Okay.
I think as a kid, I didn't really get to grow up going to museums because my parents didn't really educate me in that sense. I think my first experience going to a museum was when I was in college, going to the Art Institute of Chicago.
Really? Okay.
So I didn't really get to experience a lot of that.
But you were collecting other things then and looking
I was always collecting rocks and fossils and always fascinated. Well, that partially came from my father because he was always taking us to parks. And I think this is kind of like a way of me rekindling my own childhood in some senses, what I was experiencing. So,
how'd you end up at RISD? I mean, that's, you know, fantastic school. And you know, at what point did you say, okay, you know, I art is something I want to make part of my life?
Well, when I graduated with my BFA from NIU in DeKalb, I took about a year off to just sort of digest things, but then I went back to my professors and I asked them what school should I apply to, and they gave me a list of schools, and RISD happened to be on that list.
Yeah.
And I applied to it and I got accepted, and they were like, well, you have to go.
Yeah, so, well, of course.
so that's where I went.
And that was where you first started doing similar work to what you're doing now, or playing around with those ideas, or?
Actually, the work that I'm creating now is sort of a fusion
of
the work that I was making when I was in undergraduate school and the work that I was making while in graduate school, because they sort of, when I got into RISD and started my classes, they sort of deconstructed everything that I was doing when I was an undergrad. And the things I was doing in undergrad actually were very textural.
Okay.
But then the work that I started to create in graduate school actually was void of actual texture, because surface texture, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because...
And these were canvases you were working on, or also sculptural pieces, or...?
No, most of them were just canvas pieces on panel.
Okay.
So the work that I'm creating now is not really a departure, but a fusion of a few of the mold. Because what I was making when I was an undergrad, it was more sculptural, had more actual texture. And it had that, and then the work when I started making when I was in grad school also had a lot of texture at first. But then they sort of destroyed that in critiques. You know, like they do. They usually just rip you apart in critiques, which is needed.
And then you build yourself back up.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you ever get the desire when you're looking at maybe someone else's painting to, think what's underneath it, or want to, because I look at your work, and again, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it sort of almost looks like a core sample has been taken from a painting, like, you know, to take someone else, like a sample of someone else's painting or someone else's work, and just like see what that would look like. I mean, I know that's a different process than what you're doing with building it up, but.
Well, that would be a very fascinating idea. I mean, I would love to do that to a lot of paintings, but I mean, they often have underlayers in their paintings that start out sort of abstract at first, but then they sort of build more realistic as they get, you know, like as they finish the painting.
Yeah, Yeah. So tell me about the show that you're doing at Artbox. For the listeners who don't know, Artbox is building this, technically part of the Stutz, but just off the Stutz, off of West 10th Street. Great gallery space. And you're doing a show there titled Deliberation with new works by you as well as Max Tolkien.
Yeah. In this show, I'm going to have a lot of my specimen pieces and... totally around, I'm going to have a whole wall that's going to be around 300 of these specimen pieces.
Wow.
And I install them, and then they're each numbered. They each have an accession number to log them. And they're all named painting specimens. And I don't give them any other name simply because I don't want to name that object.
Mm-hmm.
I want the viewer to be able to come and sort of bring their own ideas to the sort of object that's there. And then besides those 300 specimen pieces, I'm going to have around seven large paintings ranging from 8 foot by 4 foot to as small as 3 foot by 4 foot paintings.
Now, the paintings that you're showing, are they similar to the specimen work you're doing, or are these totally different?
They're similar in the sense that the specimens come out of them.
Okay.
Without these paintings, the specimens would really not exist. And really, it's hard to describe them because within these paintings they become there's a sort of archaeology that happens mm-hmm. in these paintings, and it's because I'm digging into them, and people will begin to see fossils in them. So they relate. I do give these names, these paintings specific names, but they sort of very much relate to each other.
But your specimens are actually physically taken from some of these paintings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. And people will be able to see that
yeah.
if they sort of pay attention enough.
Very cool. You know, one thing that I certainly think about when I look at your work is the physicality of the paint, the acrylic paint. And it leaves me wondering... are there certain acrylics that work better than others, or have you been experimenting with different types in terms of, you know, their plasticity or the way that they cut, or when you do your samples of them, or how does that process work for you?
Mostly all acrylics is like I really like this one medium called light molding paste because
okay.
it's really easy to cut into and it's kind of spongy. So often I will mix that medium with my paint to sort of make it easier to cut into.
Mm-hmm.
Because you normally need a really sharp blade.
Yeah. I would imagine you probably go through as many blades as you do paint.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But most acrylic is pretty easy to cut into, though, because essentially it's plastic,
yeah.
really. And it's very easy to mold. You just sort of have to... shape it and learn how to use it.
Travis DiNicolo with artist Mark Pack. His paintings and sculptures will be on exhibit at the Art Box Gallery in June, along with sculpture by Max Tolkien. The show is called Deliberation, and it opens on Friday, June 5th. Art Box is located at 217 West 10th Street near the Stutz. For more information, visit artboxindie.com. That's artboxindie.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
University Theater professors John Green and Diane Timmerman have created a brand new outreach program that provides for the annual presentation of work by international theater artists and companies, plus a chance for those artists to work closely with Butler students and faculty, and with the community at large. International Theater Indianapolis kicks off next weekend with The Beckett Project, four plays by Samuel Beckett, produced by visiting artists Philip Zerilli and the Lenarth Group. John Green and Diane Timmerman stopped in to tell Sharon Gamble more.
So, John, I can't help but think of International Theater Indianapolis as both a lovely parting gift to the Indianapolis community from you, as well as kind of a passing of the baton. Diane, I know the two of you have been involved in making Butler more international, getting us more on the world stage, no pun intended, for several years. But International Theater Indianapolis is a brand new program, and I want to start with the big picture description. What is it? What do you intend by it?
I'll kick off and then let Diane fill in all the details. Really, International Theatre Indianapolis has grown out of what we've been doing at Butler for the past 6 or 7 years, which is an annual summer program called the Butler International Theatre Exchange Project, or BITE for short, where we've invited an international artist to come to the Butler campus for 2 weeks to work with and train our students and local theatre artists. And usually at the end of these two-week workshops, they will present as a free public show and tell what has been accomplished over those 2 weeks. But occasionally we've had artists in who've wanted to create something, create a finished product. And it seemed to Diane and I that as we observed these and hosted these, that there was a natural transition from doing things purely for Butler and for professional artists in the city to exposing the whole city to international work through public performances.
Mm-hmm. Right. And for the local artists who don't get the creative renewal, or their creative renewal is over, but they still want that international experience, our hope is to bring people here and have a true exchange. So have an international director, say, come and work with a group of local actors on a production. Maybe bring in an international designer and have them partner with some local folks to create a piece. So the idea is that when you really work with somebody, you get to know them. And so we'd also like to host their productions, whatever international artists we bring in, so be a producing organization. But I think the real exciting thing for the city of Indianapolis and certainly the local artists is to be able to actually work with people from different cultures and see what comes of that.
You know, it's funny. We tend to think that between the internet and cable television and, you know, all the many ways we have to communicate around the world, that we think that our modern technology has sort of homogenized everything. But it hasn't, and it must be tremendously stimulating to encounter fellow theater artists in other parts of the world who are on some completely different path because of something that they're incorporating into their art that nobody here has thought to do.
That's right. And so how exciting would that be to have that right here in our own backyard? And I think it goes along with the city of Indianapolis has over the last decade really been really trying to expand its international mission, certainly the sister cities in the area of sports and other arts, too. There's a real sense of us wanting to get connected with the world. And so we'd like to provide the theater side of that.
And we shouldn't underestimate the impact of Indianapolis on all the guest artists we've brought in to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of them has discovered the city, because very few of them, and I would include myself when I first came, know much about the city. They know that it has the speedway, and that's about it. But when they actually get into the city, and albeit they only spend 2 weeks here, they do get to see people, meet people, see the city, and in every single case, they've wanted to come back. And in many cases, they have come back, so that we've been able to build what we now call a rolling partnership with artists. And it's great when they become more and more familiar with the city, that they actually don't just want to work on the Butler campus anymore. They want to go out and work in the city. They want to work with the IMA. They want to collaborate with the Phoenix or the IRT.
So Philip Zerilli, who's coming in very soon, has I understand that he's actually from the United States originally, but he's been in the UK for a long time, and mm-hmm. he's been really fascinated by what is called, and I want one or both of you to explain this to me, psychophysical process. What is psychophysical process in the context of theater?
Philip Zirilli has become the person to combine Western theater practice with Asian theater practice. The psychophysical process, not to get too technical for our listeners, basically stems back to the teachings and the trainings of Stanislavski. And for Western theater practice, everything goes back to Konstantin Stanislavski, the great Russian theatrical innovator. And basically, it's training the mind and the body to develop a character. For a long time, the training in the West tended to be from the inside out, building a character through psychology and then transferring that into the body. The Asian theater practice is entirely different. Asian theater practice and training is all about the body and training the body and the voice, and that's how you develop character. Also, Asian theater practice, as many of our listeners will know, really is almost like a master-disciple process where the individual is taught by a master and learns rigorous technique from the master. And Zirilli has undergone 25 years of training in Asian martial arts, Asian yoga, various Indian techniques. And certainly in India, theater is just theater. There's no distinction between dance, song, dramatic presentation. It's all just theater. So he has rigorously trained with masters in this process, and his whole approach now is to try and apply, and I think he applies very successfully, the Asian forms of training and process to Western theatre practice without it being a copy. You know, he's not trying to make Western artists into Asian theatre artists. He's synthesizing the technique.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's an amazing person. I have a little project going on with World Theatre, and I've been doing a lot of reading, particularly about India and other areas of the world. And he's written some of the seminal books on world theatre practices. I mean, his book, World Theatre Histories, is the book about performance practices around the world. And he's gone off for years. You know, he's lived in little villages in India and literally all over the world. So we're very excited to have him with us because he's the top of the line in world theater. He's done it all. He knows it all, really. And also, by all reports, he's a really fine person.
Well, those are two good things to have together.
That's right.
It doesn't do very much good to have someone of great knowledge who isn't generous with sharing it.
That's right.
He also has a great website, and we'll include that at the end of our interview, how to get there. And there's a big section on an Indian martial art form called Kalaripayattu that translates, one translation is when the body becomes all eyes. Which, you know, just thinking about that in the context of theater, that's so different from starting inside and, you know, imagining the backstory of, you know, the character before he came to be in the script that you're working on or what have you. And the Lanarth Group is his theater company.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Why Beckett? Why four plays by Beckett?
I think, firstly, that his latest book, he talks about those projects. I think also he found Beckett's material to be admirably suited to illustrating how one can take these Asian theatre practices and apply them to a Western text and can train actors to do that. And he's since gone on to other material by people like Sarah Kane. But what's interesting about Beckett's late plays at the moment, these are plays written after his great classics, Waiting for Godot and Endgame, which I think most of our listeners will be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
These late plays in the last 5 or 10 years have become star vehicles around the world. It's like suddenly the world theater rediscovered them or discovered them for the first time. So actors like Michael Gambon, directors like Peter Brook have honed in, actors like Gabriel Byrne have honed in on these late plays and really turn them into exciting theatrical events.
And I'm not sure that any of these four has been seen here.
A couple of them have been produced by us at Butler, but Philip Zirilli's presentations will be the first professional productions in Indianapolis. And also, he, unlike we at Butler, he adheres very closely to Beckett's instructions, so in the ways of staging them. So I think one of the exciting things about Zirilli's presentation will not only be that he is presenting his training through these plays, but he's presenting Beckett's plays in the way that Beckett would have liked to see them. So they are almost pure Beckett, and I think that's very exciting. And also the pieces he's chosen are extremely accessible to an audience who know nothing about Beckett, and in my experience, very funny.
Are these shorter works?
These are very short
works. They'll be presented, yeah. All four will be presented each night.
Each one lasts approximately between 20, 25 minutes. Yeah.
Ohio Impromptu, Not I, Act Without Words 1, and Rockabee. I have to ask about, since they're right next door to us, Ohio Impromptu.
Ohio Impromptu was commissioned by Ohio University from Beckett to celebrate his centenary. And he created the play for this conference in honor of him. And then when he got to the conference, legend has it, the play had no title. And they said, well, Mr. Beckett, what are we going to call this? And he thought and then said, let's call it Ohio Impromptu, as I'm here. and so the title has nothing to do, sadly, with Ohio, except it recognizes the fact that Beckett was invited to write it for this conference in Ohio. But it's a wonderful, haunting piece.
Mm-hmm. And students and faculty and of course the broader community at least as an audience will be involved. How long will he be here? How much time will you get to work with him one-on-one?
He'll be here for a couple of weeks working with a core group of people who have signed up for the workshop, and we'll work with him for those 2 weeks. And then we've got the presentation of the plays at the end of that process,
right?
And I think we've got those dates on the sign-off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where do you house visiting artists such as this gentleman?
In our beautiful apartment village at Butler University.
Uh-huh. So they have access to the campus at its most beautiful time of year.
It's lovely. People really love it. They love it, and we take them downtown. We take them to all the sites. And part of the mission of International Theater Indianapolis is not just to bring all the good stuff here and so that we can all be enlightened as Hoosiers, but
that would be selfish if we only just brought it in.
But also for them to learn from us, and so we'd like to take our guest artists to the Phoenix, to the IRT, to the local museums, to Heartland Actors Repertory Theater, and really get them to get involved with the local art scene as it is here.
And hopefully during that 2 weeks we'll set up a series of informal lunch conversations, dinner conversations, where professional artists who are unable to participate in the workshop can meet with him, because I know that Philip and his company are very anxious, as Diane says, to meet with local artists and find out what happens in Indianapolis.
Sharon Gamble with John Green and Diane Timmerman, founders of the International Theater Indianapolis. The new program kicks off next weekend with the Beckett Project. Four plays by Samuel Beckett, produced by visiting artist Philip Zirilli and the Lenarth Group. You can see the plays in the Black Box Theater in Lilly Hall at Butler University on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8 p.m. Tickets are $15 for the general public and $10 for students. For tickets, call Luann Baker at 940-9659. Again, that's 317-940-9659. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Did the Memorial Day holiday seem early to you this year?
It seemed very early.
It did. You know, it came sort of, I think, about as early as it can come this year, which it almost makes it feel like we have an extra week of May.
It does. It's
which is
true.
Sort of like that extra week of that, you know, before summer really kicks off, but it's getting nice out finally. And I think it's a perfect time to use that extra week to go out and see some great art events. What do you think?
I think that's a fabulous idea. Did you have something in mind to kick off
you
our
know,
little calendar thing?
I do, and let's talk about it on
What'll
We
Do? Oh, so subtle are we.
So subtle we are. That's so true. Actually, this weekend is a Naptown Roller Girl bout, you know. Yes, it's true. It's true. Saturday night, Naptown Roller Girls are in town once again.
Who are we up against?
And they are in a big bout against, you know, does it really matter?
No, of course not.
Sure. Okay.
why do I even ask?
But at the State Fairgrounds, yeah.
It's and, about the wheels and the clothes, folks.
There you go. That's what I'm doing this weekend. How about you?
I can picture you in Naptown Roller Girl attire, but thankfully it's radio.
Right.
You know, I loved your interview with the Yo-Yo guys last
That's
week.
That's right. They're fun.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of Native American things, don't forget the 17th annual. Can't believe it's been 17 years already. Idle Jug Museum Indian Market and Festival is coming up. It's in about 3 weeks. It's Saturday, June 27th, Sunday, June 28th. It's an opportunity to talk with artisans, purchase their wonderful works. There are activities for kids that expose them to some Native American art forms, such as weaving and so forth. And there's just so much great stuff going on. Once again, that is at the Idle Jug Museum. It's from 10 to 5 on both Saturday, June 27th and Sunday, June 28th, the Indian Market and Festival.
That's always a great event.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting a dance piece by Gregory Hancock Dance Theater, India Ever After.
Hmm.
And once again, of course, Gregory Hancock Dance Company's dance theater is known for their presentations of dances inspired by, in fact, they've done a number of pieces now of dances inspired by the art, music, film, and dance of India. And so this is just sort of a way to travel to India for the summer with the GHDT, with a short trip up to the Pike Performing Arts Center, where they're performing on June 12th and 13th, both evenings at 8 o'clock, to present this all-new program of India-inspired dances. And it will be a feast for the eyes and the ears, with lots of colorful and exotic costumes and Indian music, and it should be a lot of fun. It's of course, will feature some work inspired by Bollywood style dance, as well as a classical Indian dance and some fusion and folk dance as well. You know, they always continue to surprise and amaze at the Gregory Hancock Dance Theater.
Absolutely. Speaking of trips, some people may choose to make a trip up and down Mass Ave as part of the Indy Reed Scavenger Hunt. You know a little bit about this. It's on Wednesday, June 17th from 6 to 9. You and your friends can form a team of 2 to 4 people, and if you don't have 2 to 4 friends who are available, or excuse me, 2 to 3 friends who are available, but you want to do this, you can contact Indy Reads, and they will match you up and make you part of a team. And you'll be scavenging up and down Mass Ave and all around looking for fun things. You can have a great time, and you'll be competing for fabulous prizes from Mass Ave merchants. You can find out more at the Indy Reads website, which is indyreads.org. Indyreads.org. And you'll want to get in there and hop on and get registered soon, because that's coming up on Wednesday, June 17th from 6 to 9.
You know, and a couple of people have said, you know, is this a race? And it should be clear, it's not actually a race. In fact, we encourage you to linger at the shops, even take a pit stop at one of the beverage establishments.
And in fact, having a glass of wine or a beer or maybe a latte might inspire you to be a better scavenger.
There you go.
Or buying me some jewelry from Silver in the City. Oh,
like
I didn't really say that out loud.
Yeah. speaking of jewelry, actually, the Indiana Handicraft Exchange, is actually going to be taking place at the Harrison Center for the Arts, and it features 70 vendors as well as live music Saturday, June 13th. It's a biannual show, and again, it is the Indiana Handicraft Exchange, which sounds very cool. So that will be coming up fairly soon.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, if you've promised yourself that you'll get out and do something a little different this summer, you know, summer is a more laid-back time. People are usually feeling more relaxed. Maybe you've been thinking, hey, I could take some acting classes. You might want to contact Stage Actors Workshop, which is about to launch a series of 6 weekly acting classes. You can contact Stage Actors Workshop at SAW_theater, spelled E-R, at yahoo.com. So saw_theater, theater at yahoo.com for more information about stage actors, workshops, new acting classes.
Cool. Hey, Primary Colors is at it again with an installation exhibition called Installation Nation, Outstanding Art Inside Shipping Containers.
That's right. I read about that. I am fascinated by that.
That's right. Shipping Containers. So this is going to take place Friday, June 5th, as well as Saturday, June 6th at 500 North College Avenue, which is right across from the Lockerbie Pub on North College, basically at North College Avenue and East Michigan Street. So they've taken over a lot. They're going to have tents set up and shipping containers, and they do warn people that it is a gravel lot, so it may pose a little difficulty for some patrons with limited mobility, but they're going to have music there both nights, Friday the 5th and Saturday the 6th, including DJ Twin Peaks and the Mysticos Quintet electronic music and Motif DJ and E. Brown electronic music, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. But there's going to be a lot of artists who are going to be creating these installation pieces within the confines of these 5 40-foot metal shipping containers. And the work features artists such as Jeff Martin, Lori Miles, Brian Priest, as well as, in addition to Indianapolis artists, artists from Columbus, Ohio, and New Albany, and Grand Rapids, Michigan. Again, it's all about location with installation. There you go. Location, location, location. Friday, June 5th, Saturday, June 6th, down on Mass Avenue.
Just don't let anybody load those pods onto a truck and take them away. We need to keep our artists here.
Right.
The Theater Within is at it again with another thought-provoking play. It's Martin Sherman's Bent. Some of the questions it raises: am I my brother's keeper? Are there angels among us? What is love? It's a Holocaust-era story that probes some of these life-altering questions and offers an intimate portrait of a culture at a crossroads, let's just say. It's at the Theater Within, which is at the Church Within, 1125 Spruce Street, 4 blocks east of Fountain Square along Prospect Street, immediately south of the KFC. And the dates are June 5th, 6th, 12th, 13th, 19th, and 20th, 8 p.m., all of those dates. You can go to thechurchwithin.org for more information about those performances.
There's a lot going on that weekend.
Absolutely.
June 6th and 7th and stuff. That's also the Woodruff Place Flea Market.
Yeah.
Which is going to be taking place then. And?
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 What else?
The Blue Monkey Sideshow, Sword
They're
Swallowing
back.
And Glass Walking, performed by professors and a therapist. That's right. Well, they performed all over Indiana at college campuses, fairs, and festivals, and now the Blue Monkey Sideshow is coming to the Arthur M. Glick JCC for two shows only, family shows, June 6th and 7th. These five performers are celebrating 10 years of entertaining audiences with their frequently freakish presentations of classic and contemporary sideshow feats. But don't let these guys fool you. They may be masters of juggling, sword swallowing, and walking on glass, but behind the scenes, one of them's an occupational therapist and former fourth grade teacher with a master's of science degree. And then there's another one who's got an MFA, in theater design and theater technology. Another one was a teacher as well. They're all coming together to perform.
Can I just say all of those professions?
Crembo, Skanky, and the Swami.
All of those professions are just like walking on glass. I'm just saying.
So, this is taking place Saturday, June 6th, Sunday, June 7th. Both shows, again, kids are encouraged for these up at the JCC.
All right, it's time to gather your picnic, your favorite beverage,
Ready?
The mosquito spray.
Yep.
You're heading outdoors
to
see Roman Holiday next Friday night at sunset at the IMA in the amphitheater on the west side of the museum. The Summer Nights film series is back.
That sounds lovely, Sharon. Oh, what a nice way to spend an evening.
Absolutely.
Well, and if you have some ideas for nice ways to spend an evening, shoot us an email at artofthematter@wfyi.org. We'd love to include it on the calendar. And until then, next week we will be back with more, Sharon, on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202,
or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The Guarneri Quartet has circled the globe many times and played in the most prestigious halls in the Americas, Europe, Asia, and Australia since its formation in 1964. Having announced its retirement at the completion of the 2008-2009 concert season, the group will celebrate by doing what it has done for the last 45 years, touring extensively and releasing new recordings. Their concert in Indianapolis will feature some favorite works of the quartet by composers Haydn and Ravel. Travis DiNicola spoke with John Faley, president of the Ensemble Music Society, to find out more.
Well, I am excited to hear about this concert that the Ensemble Music Society is presenting that's coming up. This is quite a big deal from what I understand. I know my co-host Sharon Gamble has been very excited about it for weeks. Tell me a bit about this as someone who is not as familiar with the Guarneri String Quartet.
The Guarneri String Quartet is closing out their career of 45 years together with this, their final season of touring. And as was once said on an edition of NPR, I think when they were on Performance Today, they really are among the most revered and enduring ensembles of their kind in the world. And they've, over 45 years together, made 50 or 60 recordings. They've been around the world multiple times. They've they've been in every major concert hall in the world. And so to be able to have them come to Indianapolis for their final season together is really quite a thrill.
Now, the quartet consists of Arnold Steinhardt on violin, John, is it Daly?
Daly,
on violin, as well as Michael Tree on viola and Peter Wiley on cello. Has it always been the same lineup in the quartet over all those years?
Or? When they first started back in 1964, coincidentally the same year that the Beatles first came to the U.S. and appeared on Ed Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
But at that point, their cellist was a gentleman named David Sawyer, who was about 8 or 10 years older than most of the other guys in the quartet. So about 8 years ago, he retired from the quartet, and he was replaced by Peter Wiley, who for a long time had performed with Menachem Pressler in the Beaux-Arts Trio. But other than that, it's the same, you know, group of guys from the beginning, which is really remarkable.
And, you know, it really is. And they've just released their final recording. I understand they that came out in February, and it's titled the Hungarian Album.
That's right. They're doing they released a recording of the quartets of Zoltán Kodály as well as of Ernst von Dohnányi. My Hungarian pronunciations are not so good. I can pronounce Guarneri a lot more readily. But it's significant late Romantic Hungarian composers, and they really are some of the quartet's favorite works. And the Kodály Quartet that's featured on that recording will also be part of their performance here on June 6th.
Oh, very good. So, so they're sort of touring to promote the final album as well. This is quite a important coup for the Ensemble Music Society, is it not, to be able to bring them in during their final tour?
It really is, and this is a concert that that almost didn't happen for us. It was originally scheduled for February, and then, you know, something came up in the lives of one of the musicians in the quartet, and they had to cancel that performance. So it was really kind of tricky to even find, you know, a final date to, mm-hmm. to bring them back. And so we were scrambling for a while to see if we could still make it happen. So, boy, am I relieved that it is going to happen.
Well, congratulations on that. And for our listeners who are not as familiar with the Ensemble Music and the Ensemble Music International Chamber Series and what it is that you present, tell me a bit about the organization that that you are the president of, John.
Travis, this is this will be the final concert of our 65th season. So we've been a part of the Indianapolis music scene for quite a long time, and many more years than I have on the calendar. And we do chamber music that's principally quartets and trios, occasionally small chamber orchestras, but usually between 4 to 8 musicians. And over history, we find that the composers who wrote great symphonies also wrote some of their finest works for small ensembles like this. And so it's an important part of the music literature to present to audiences.
Absolutely. And certainly the music is different, the feel is different, the intimacy is different, and you can focus on the musicians in certainly a different way when there's you have a smaller ensemble as opposed to a larger symphony. Also a wonderful experience as well, but just very different types of musical experiences for audiences.
Well, that's right. Normally we present our concerts at the 300-seat auditorium at the Indiana History Center, but the Guarneri Quartet is going to be at the slightly larger Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center,
mm-hmm.
and so we're excited about that. But to get 300-seat auditorium, that's really the right size for things like this, and it makes it very intimate. It makes it an experience where even at the back of the hall, you feel very close to the musicians and the performance.
Now, this wraps up your 65th season. I know that you've got plans for your upcoming season. Will many of those shows also be at Crystal DeHaan with the History Center? I know they're going under some renovation right now, and
yes.
So not all the spaces are available, including the main auditorium there.
Well, that was one of the reasons why our program with the Guarneri String Quartet is going to be at Crystal DeHaan. But next fall, in October, we move back to the History Center, and all of our programs are planned to be there.
Oh, great. So it'll all be ready by then for you.
That's right.
They
said October 1st and after, we're good to go.
Very good, because that's such a great space, I think, to hear almost any type of music. I just really like that facility. So tell me a bit about your upcoming season, just to give us a preview.
We're going to open next season with the Ying Quartet, and it's unusual that you have any ensemble today that's made up entirely of family members. And the Yings are, brothers and sister, and they've been playing together for probably 15 years, and I think this will be their third appearance on our series, and you couldn't ask for a nicer group of people to engage an audience and be welcoming and inviting to people and tell them about the works that are going to be performed. And they're going to be appearing on that concert with Christopher Taylor on piano. Chris Taylor was an American Pianist Association fellow in 2000.
Okay.
He was also a silver medalist in the Van Cliburn competition around that time, and a very talented individual in many respects. He also happened to graduate summa cum laude in math from Harvard, and so, you know, he's not just a great musician, he's got a great intellect as well. But they'll be doing the Brahms Quintet in F minor, We're then doing the St. Lawrence Quartet in November, and they're doing two works on their program. They're doing the Beethoven Opus 31 Quartet in C-sharp minor, which many people compare to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And they were written around the same time, but in the quartet literature, it's a very significant work. And they're coupling that with a work that was written by the contemporary composer John Adams and was just premiered earlier this year, a string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we jump to January. We have a German piano quartet, piano, violin, viola, and cello, that will be performing, you know, some Brahms and Mozart again. And then in February, we have a new music ensemble named Brooklyn Rider. It's a group that has engaged audiences in new ways, sometimes in tavern and nightclub settings, but also in traditional concert halls, like their program for us will be. But we're expecting that to be a kind of a different sort of chamber music experience than than we've typically offered. In March, we're very excited about presenting Sergio and Odair Assad, two Brazilian brothers on guitars that sort of they're my personal heroes in classical guitar. They are absolutely amazing, and I think that while I like our entire season, I think that that's one that I would not want to miss.
Well, you're certainly smiling as you talk about them, so I can tell you're a big fan.
They're wonderful. I've heard them live in concert once before, about 7 years ago, and you know, it was just amazing. So we're excited about that. And then we'll close the season with the Takash Quartet, again making a return visit to our series, because I happen to believe that they're really one of the best quartets in the world today. So if the Guarneri retires, then I'm going to, you know, take the Takash as a backup any day.
Travis DiNicola with John Faley, president of the Ensemble Music Society. The Guarneri will perform in Indianapolis on June 6th at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center. For details about the Guarneri Quartet concert on the Ensemble Music series, visit ensemblemusic.org. Again, ensemblemusic.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 p.m. I'll chat with writer Ingrid Cummings about how to cross-train your brain.
I'll preview the summer season for the Indianapolis Early Music Festival.
I get to take a stroll with the Indianapolis Garden Club Garden Walk. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.